เนี่ย
Take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to be. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
It seems that you've been living two lives. In one life, you're Thomas A. Anderson, program writer for a respectable software company.You have a social security number, you pay your taxes, and you help your landlady carry out her garbage. The other life is lived in computers, where you go by the hacker alias Neo and are guilty of virtually every computer crime we have a law for.
This is the main deck.Where we broadcast our pirate signal and hack into the Matrix.
Everyone, welcome to the June edition of In the Now, June 1st, actually.
Hola.
This is Slip Mode, your host this evening, along with
Sidekick VR.
Sidekick VR. Tell you the truth, we're actually doing the show just a little bit early than June 1st because I had some bad scheduling as far as my trip to Miami this weekend, which is the weekend just before June 1st. So we had to do the show now. But I wanted to get it to you for June 1st. We got plenty of good information, so let's get at it. How you been doing, VR?
Oh, just dapper and dandy as always. I love all these, you know, life's logistical errors bring about variants and new opportunities. So I'm actually kind of pleased that we're doing this at an odd time. It's kind of fun.
Yeah. Well, also, too... Everyone doesn't really know, but the people in the house know, which is me and VR. And actually, you know, we probably could have had a few other people make it to the show, but it's kind of an impromptu show, and me and VR hang out quite often. So, but we're doing it in the studio now. We have the black light going.
Oh, yeah.
We're sitting here in the black light. And
really longing for a disco ball and any of those little color light thingies. A couple of lava lamps. That'd be cool.
You remember the USB disc ball?
Yeah, that idea. I'm working on it, actually.
All right.
I've got my research team going at it as we speak. Too bad they're a little bit more efficient than 100 monkeys typing at keyboards trying to type out the Bible. But they'll get it eventually.
Awesome. All right. Well, this show, we have a lot of good information for you. Of course, we're going to do our review of The Matrix Reloaded. And actually, we just came from watching The Matrix Reloaded.
Oh, yeah, and I'm still on a little mental buzz.
Oh, man, that show has got so much to offer. And you had said it best. There are going to be two types of movies now.
That's right. There's going to be The Matrix series and everything else.
I remember, well, you know, we'll get into that when we get into The Matrix. Got a few stories we're going to talk about, just miscellaneous things. We're going to go into the SCO versus Linux versus IBM problem, and some interesting stuff about some Russian hackers / crackers that were arrested a few months back on some charges. Well, if you've watched The Matrix, or if you've watched other movies out there like Minority Report that use those liquid displays, those displays that are see-through while they're doing all their work and computer transactions and whatnot. Well, I read a promising article that talks about that technology is being developed. It doesn't say it's quite here yet. It's kind of way in its alpha stages. Scientists say high-speed circuitry from Japan someday could form the innards of devices now seen only in science fiction, such as televisions made of nothing but hunks of transparent crystal. Wager and his team invented the first clear transistor, which are reported in March, although they were not high-performance enough for display applications. There are a few drawbacks that they're working on. The secret of new transistors is they are made of single crystals. Earlier transistors were polycrystalline, that is. They were composed of many tiny single crystals lumped together. That construction approach is problematic because whenever electrons must hop from one crystal to the other, they actually slow down. So that would be really neat to see that technology. That would actually that could be used in so many places.
Oh, yeah. I could really see that in, like, interpersonal, you know, relations. Is you could actually have your girlfriend or your wife standing behind the TV so she really feels that you're listening to her. And, well, you can look at her and still watch TV at the same time.
Oh, yet another good use and idea from VR.
Thank you. Can we tell that I'm just a little bitter? I think I'm so bitter that there's not enough salt in the world to cut my bitterness.
Well, I've definitely been bitter on this show about things, and some things are due the bitter that they deserve, so... yeah.
I'm just looking for the bittersweet.
The bittersweet.
That's right. But if it could be sweet and spicy, oh, I would be in heaven. So
I think I would be in heaven as well. You know, actually, I got this next story here that I want to talk about, but one story pops into mind that I didn't actually... I bring a lot of the literature here. I keep summaries of it and use that to help me describe the information to all you listeners out there. But this next one actually is totally in my head, and I did not bring in the paperwork for it. And I just wanted to kind of talk a little bit about it. I don't have all the details, but the gist and the message is there.
That's because he just doesn't have a mirror that he could, you know, like, read the back of his head with.
Exactly.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of... It brought a nifty visual to my mind, anyway, that you had it written on your head.
I think ever since we talked about see-through stuff, you're getting pretty crazy with that.
Oh, yeah, that's just... My imagination just starts to soar with those kinds of things.
Definitely. This story is about a company that had a piece of equipment that we used for divers. It was a diving computer, per se, and I think it was actually a watch. Yeah, it was a diving watch. And what the problem of it was is that there was a glitch in its programming that would actually, while you're going through and doing deep dives, it would actually tell you the different amount of, like, if you did deep dives if you did it frequently, the calculations would eventually become incorrect. And what those calculations would tell you is your safest amount of time for being down at deep levels because of the decompression, the compression, nitrogen levels. And basically, it even tells you if you're okay to fly and get in a plane after that. Because actually, if you go down and you spend too much time down there, your nitrogen levels go up too much.
Because you're oversaturated in your the liquids in your system with air or with nitrogen and oxygen. And so if you go from really down deep and then not enough time surpasses for that to expel from your body and you go into a plane,
Yeah.
It's messy.
Which is exactly what happened to a few divers. I guess this has actually been a story for, you know, for a while. Not anything really publicly known, but the whole time the diving company actually said that there was nothing wrong with their watches, denied everything. There are a few executives that are actually within the company that wanted to come out and tell the public about it, actually issue a callback of all the watches, and they got fired and they were replaced with new people. They even actually had a famous diver, which I don't have the story here to tell you the name, got on board, didn't know anything about these things whatsoever as being problematic, eventually found out because he had got a memo, I believe, sent to him that these things were problematic. He asked the company about it. You know, they just got rid of him, and I guess they're finally getting sued by some of these divers, and they are now issuing a recall. It's coincidental. They just happened to find it. They never saw it before. And
it's a voluntary recall.
Yeah, it's a voluntary recall. Sounds like a bunch of idiots, and that really sucks, and that could really put your life in danger. So we've talked about, you know,
and
how could computers...
That's one thing about the, yeah, the, like, limited liability, you know, corporations and those sorts of things, is it really takes a lot of the personal responsibility out of decision-making of corporations, that they can't be individually sued for the decisions that they made in the job. Like...
But they, can't they be arrested? I mean, you know, some of the people from the,
Yeah, if they do actually something criminally wrong, but if just in their decision-making of in day-to-day operations of the company, you can't sue, like, one of the vice presidents of R.J. Reynolds. You can sue the company, but they're not actually the entity. They just work for the publicly traded thing because we all own it.
Yeah.
Or all the,
well, yeah.
All the shareholders, you know, actually own it, so you... To really do that, you have to also sue
I'm
the shareholder.
I'm kind of thinking here, yeah, they could actually say that, well, no, we didn't have any knowledge, really. And then
That's
if they
right.
could prove that they actually didn't have any knowledge, they'd actually have to find some malice to where knowledge was presented, and then they just said discredited the knowledge.
Right.
So,
but now if you, what's just really strange is that's just some legal paperwork that has to be signed. But if you go out and you do some work for somebody just on the side or whatnot, and you know, you hurt somebody on it, you can be personally sued for it. Even though you did it for a job and whatnot, it's just some legal paperwork that creates this huge responsibility loophole, which is really funny because, you know, responsibility and accountability is the battle cry of the bureaucrat, but yet at the same time, it's the complete opposite. It's a strange paradox of our legal system.
Yeah, it seems like there's always... It seems like there's always an option, whether it be a bad option, whether it be a good option. And if you play your cards right on either sides of the table, you might win your game. And I guess it's just the battle that's ahead of us as human beings to try to make things right, whatever, you know, that perspective may be, which is all perspective. All right. Well, you know, this is I've noticed this school popping up. It's a school in Calgary. It's the Institute, the University of Calgary. They're actually developing malicious software, viruses, worms, Trojan horses, and they will soon be a part of a program for 16 students at the university. The aim is to delve into computer crime, the computer criminal's mind to understand the problem that causes billions of dollars of damage worldwide, as well as develop their own versions of the I Love You virus, the bug bear worm. Students will study ethical and security issues in the computer viruses malware. That's interesting. You know, I'm actually, there's a new course that I'm actually starting to take on June 10th that popped up, which is information system security. So these things are actually popping up all around. I do believe that there is some things like that I will be taking in the school that I will be going to as well.
I think it's almost a necessity where you have to, you know, the best way to catch a thief is to kind of learn how to be a thief, or to look like, you know, to take on the perspective and the abilities of a thief, so you know what to look for, you know how to fight it, you know how to, if you know how to create it, you know how to destroy it, kind of paradigm.
Yeah, it seems like I think this is the history of why our let me just say this way. The history that I know of is kind of like in the 70s and the 60s and the 80s and building up to the early 90s, that building technology for humanity was just actually it was just kind of enjoyment. Like, wow, you know, I got this thing to do this and it works for me. And of course, there was always people out there at all times that were thinking about what they could do to the technology for other means that it was intended to. But as it grew, you know, at the times it was growing, it was very limited and minimal as far as its production and how available it was to everybody. The people that have been exploiting things and doing things bad with technology and information has been going on, you know, since the very beginning. I'm sure that some of the developers of said technology or whatever knew its maliciousness that could be used in some instances of things. I just didn't use it and hoped that other people wouldn't. But now, since it's everywhere else and anybody can get their hands on it and it's so widespread and, you know, I mean, every person that's like, you know, as soon as they're old enough to get their hands on a keyboard, you know, is trying to learn how to use the web and email and chat programs, that it's so wide now that people have actually started to use it and use it in bad ways. And now, I guess, over the last, probably the end of the 90s and definitely the early, you know, earlier 2000 of this, you know, for 2000, 2001 and so on, definitely has finally hit the people saying that, wow, you know, now this is an everyday portion of our life, and now it's a whole new thing to worry about. Before, it was something you never even cared to worry about, never even had a problem with it.
Since I think it is that, you know, when you study a program, or you use it quite a bit, is you learn about what, you know, what its faults are, and how you can, and some of the benefits of it, and you use to, you find, when you find those, you exploit them either for your own goods, or you avoid them because they impede your what you're trying to do. And then I think the same thing of like studying on how those kinds of viruses and things are created, that you can learn how to exploit them in both the positive and negative ways. As you can learn how, you know, what their faults are, so it's much easier to thwart their progress. Or you might be able to find out that you can use them to, you know, almost where they go into computers and upgrade everything for you. You just, here's your, you know, like, inoculation. I know that's really far out there, but it's an idea.
Well, the, I don't know, it's really strange, the whole thing, because I believe that, you know, people that usually write viruses and you know, people that have attained, you know, title hacker, you know, for the right reasons, those people, you know, are really it. You know, those are the guys that are really doing it. And I feel when I go to the school, you know, or, you know, other people that go to schools like that, and eventually, you know, it'll be a common class, you know, or set of classes that will actually be producing dumb people with the title hackers and dumb people that have the title "I'm a virus writer." You know that there's going to be a cultural battle between the white collared educated, as far as going to school for a hacker type degree, security degree, versus the people that actually sit all day long and do nothing but stay on their box and read, and tinker. And to me, that's where the heart of it is. That's where it actually comes from. That's where these things are occurring. I mean,
well, that's the proletariat of that culture. Those are the ones that, those are the real workhorses. Those are the ones that actually produce new ways of doing things, new ideas. And then there's the bourgeois that just kind of sit back and study it, but also the academic that sit back and study it. And then there are the bourgeois that, you know, study it, and then they can go off and do whatever they want with it and produce for their own ends. But they didn't put, you know, the blood, sweat, and tears into it as, you know, essentially the shade tree or the, you know, your bedroom hacker.
Yeah, that's a great term, the bedroom hacker.
That's right.
Because, I mean, honestly, I'm kind of familiar with the bedroom hacker, and I mean, I know of that culture, and I'm really familiar with it. I know that there is going to be a battle of, let's say, not exactly, well, let's put it this way, black hat versus the white hat, which is not exactly what it's going to be per se, but it can be. Not every black hat hacker or somebody that's really out there, you know, really doing hacking as far as developing the tools, developing the exploits, studying the code, finding out how to misuse it. I think there's going to be a group of, let's say, new age, you know, academic people that will emerge and will say, like, we have said tools. Instead of now battling the operating systems as far as their security, now we'll say, no, screw your tools. You know, now it's going to be the black hat versus the new tools out there developed by these corporations.
Well, really, it's the same thing that's already going on between those who, you know, really, you know, go and find the exploits and do what they want to do with them, and those the script kiddies that pick up the tools and do it. It's just going to be that the script kiddies are going to have more tools available to them. They're going to be more adept at using them.
Definitely.
And so that they can use more and more complex tools rather than the ones who found the exploits and really understand it. Then, you know, not everybody knows how to build a microwave, but we use them. You didn't build it. You don't know why, you know, it really works. You might, but most people don't. They just know that they put a frozen pizza in it, and they plug a few numbers, and, oh, wow, I get, you know, hot pizza. That's great. But I know just a couple people who have actually built a microwave. Now, that's the same thing as somebody who's, you know, the bedroom hacker, who's actually put into the work into understanding why a system works and why there's faults to it and how he can exploit them for his own ends. Like, you can do amazing things with a microwave if you, you know, just don't want it for food production.
Yeah, definitely. I'm actually pulling further away from the story, but I think we're going in a good direction. I've seen many script kiddies out there on the net, and it's kind of funny because they'll describe, you know, they'll ask questions on how to use a tool per se. They'll say, you know, I've got this exploit, I don't understand how to use it, or they try doing something and something breaks, you know, or it doesn't happen the way they want it, and then they don't understand. Jeez, you know, I don't know if the audience really knows, but there are a whole lot of people out there that are just taking these tools and trying to use them, and they know little, you know, some of them know little or no, nothing compared to, you know, of system administration or anything like that. And these people, you know, have gotten into a lot of machines, and then they run services on your machine, or, you know, they take your data, or you know, all sorts of stuff, and it's pretty amazing. It's you know, just the tools being out there, that so many people can actually go around and cause so much havoc.
Well, the same thing happens in every other walk of life. That, you know, I see, you know, hundreds of people every day that I'm amazed that they've lived as long as they have. You know, why? How did they survive this long? Because they don't even understand, like, why they're doing the things that they do and why the streetlights, you know, how they work. You know, when to cross and that sort of thing. You know, how many manholes did they just accidentally miss when they're open?
Yeah.
That's the same kind of paradigm. Where, you know, it's the difference between those who really understand the whole teleology of technology versus those who come into it, you know, later on and just want to use it as you know, knife and fork. But it's not. It's, you know, the most complex knife and fork you'll ever, well, that you'll see at this time. And in the future, it'll be even more.
Definitely. I'm just looking something up here on the internet for 1 second. Okay. Well, I just wanted to make sure that I got this correct link here. Okay. Yeah, I think we're going to move into another story, but I think we've left a lot of interesting information there about what's really going on. I have been toying with the idea writing a small article on system patching for BinRev, the magazine, which is www.binrev.com. And I think I'm actually going to try to cover... there's a lot of operating systems I've used myself, and I know how to cover those. I think I'm going to do some research and really try to get the real goods for other operating systems I don't use as much, and put all that into a nice article, probably not this edition, but maybe the next edition of BinRev. So take a look for that, because that's going to be really important to helping you try to patch yourself against what is known as exploitable out there.
And for all of you purists out there, no, we have not sold out, and that was not a corporate sponsorship.
No, because BinRev is not even a corporation. I'm having a fluster of thoughts right now.
Is your mind just a flurry?
It's filled with information. I'm trying to condense it to a 1 hour show or you know, a little bit over. I know there's so much information.
It's just one of those nights where you know, just want to pontificate upon everything.
Definitely. Just a small note that we said before, and we were just talking about, you know, school of teaching viruses and stuff like that, and me doing a possible article. Possible is if I get off my lazy butt and do it. The knowledge is in my head. I just got to write it. But I think it'd be a good experience for me to do it, and I think I'm going to do it. And plus, it'd be nice to
just shut up and do it.
Shed the knowledge. All right, I'm going to do it. And also, just to let you know that there are a lot of exploits out there that are not publicly known, so you got to watch out for those. All right. Well, last month we talked about our last show, actually, because we're not doing it monthly, we're doing it biweekly. Last show we talked about Apple's iTunes and how successful it is as being a model and system for downloading music and using it.
Yay.
Which is really neat. Their system works by just downloading it, and poof, you got it. $1 song. I think they have over 250,000 songs and growing. And I think you can use it as much as you want. It's yours, and you can do whatever you want with it. Well, Microsoft, I know, has been working on a system of doing the exact same thing. They've been doing this system for quite some time. They've been really conversating with a lot of leading record labels and the music industry on how they would like this technology to come forth and how it should be used. I think it sucks, and here we go. I'm going to tell you why. You can definitely tell that this is the story that I'm reading when I say this. While Apple Computer grabs publicity for its new 99-cent music download store, Microsoft is quietly preparing for the counterattack by improving its own technology for supporting subscription music services. Microsoft said it is developing software that makes it easier to subscribe services to transfer music to portable music players. These services are now provided unlimited downloads of hundreds of thousands of songs to a PC for a monthly fee, but they typically do not allow files to be moved much around. So there are going to be some limitations to how many times you can copy it, if you can copy it, and where you can play it, which that sucks.
And that's very not surprising coming from Microsoft.
Yeah. And the difference is there, I mean, really with the Apple Store is that the Apple one is you actually own it, and you can do whatever you choose, but you pay $1 per song, and Microsoft services, you actually pay a monthly fee. You can tell I'm going to read the article here, but it's just going to get this point across. Apple's music product grants permanent ownership of the files and relies on relatively light controls, which we just discussed. People who buy tracks for Apple's iTunes Music Store can burn songs up to 10 times from the same playlist, share access from 3 different computers, and transfer tracks to Apple's iPod portable music player.
That sounds like liberty to me.
Yeah, so I mean, there is a little bit of. It seems like there is a little bit of restrictions there, but it's far less limiting than the Microsoft alternative. Plus, how long is it going to take for somebody to come up with a software where you just play it through your player, whatever restrictions it may have, and something else records it, and now it's restriction free?
Yeah, well, you can instantly burn it. Well, you can copy it 10 times. Which means...
How do they know you copied it one time or two?
You burn it initially, and then, wow, look, you delete it from your playlist, and now you have complete liberty with it. You bought it.
Yeah, I don't know how they track it, but if they do, it doesn't seem very hard to circumvent sound. You can't control it.
No, it's your property. You should be able to do with it what you will. If you want to destroy it or proliferate it, that is your choice.
Yep. And I think you'll find that people will people still pay for music now, even though these services have just come about. And people will pay for music even more if these services come out, because you don't have to take as much time to hunt them down. And you might get really good fast downloads.
Yeah, it's called convenience fees.
Convenience fees. All right. And this is something I read about. Gosh, it really kind of sucks to read about this. But I guess for the new 802.11g standard, they're basically lowering what could be the data rate, the speed of the wireless technology, of the speed of the data that can be sent through the air, and actually lowering it. Seems like they're lowering it to actually still work with some older hardware.
Well, that gives you more opportunity, well, more choices for what you can work with, which is good. But in the future, when those other things become obsolete, if they keep everything, the hardware up, the new hardware up to a higher standard, then eventually they can upgrade it to the higher bit rate.
Well, yeah, it seems like they're not going to give the goods, though, right away, or they don't have any promise of giving it to you, period. The Institute of Electronic Engineers Incorporated, IEEE, has approved a new and final draft support for 802.11g wireless LANs that will have true throughput through Internet types of connections of between 10 megabits to 20 megabits per second, far lower than the 54 megabits a second raw data initially billed for the standard.
Well, unless they're doing that for like validity aspects to make sure that your encryption or whatnot, as long as those kinds of things really don't impede the bit rate overall.
Yeah, well, yeah, like they said here, the 54 megabit raw is basically, you know, not including all the other services that go along. Yeah, like encryption, encrypting your traffic, that you may make your traffic a little bit larger payload than it is just raw and normal. Of course, the TCP/IP protocol are the protocols, all the excess stuff that needs to be done, opening up connections, tearing down connections, stuff like that, you know, always actually, you know, will lower your raw data stream, but that's a given. But 54 to start with is a lot nicer than starting with 20. But I guess what they're trying to do is basically, the mixed 802.11b and 802.11g networks running installed TCP/IP network protocols, this will reduce actual throughput to 10 megabits per second, while pure 802.11g networks will still have actual data rates of around 20 megabits per second. It's pointed out that even if these data types or data rates for both the 802.11g devices still outperform the 802.11b devices, which still have a raw data bit rate of 11 megabits per second. So I don't know. It's my real take on it is basically go with what you can get. Forget the old technology and just get it done. And make them go buy new stuff. They're going to get more money anyways out of it. So, I don't know. That's my take on it. I actually fear wireless networks. I refuse to run one. I think there are plenty benefactors of wireless networks as far as not having wires. But definitely don't trust my traffic being broadcast all over the place.
Yeah, but I really hate wires. I really do. I don't like being tethered in any sort of way, except to my wallet.
Well, I did think that, you know, my room per se here, if I ever had to move it, yeah, everything in here to another place,
that'd be miles and miles of cable.
Oh, man.
I don't even want to. You'd have to have your own, like, cable spool.
How many?
Just to do that.
How many electronic devices, okay, with their own special plug, okay, electronic device with their own plug, how many think I have in this room?
I would say, I want to say 172, but it might be more than that.
Oh, my gosh. You should actually see, I have ran the cable so professionally. Like, even the cable to the blacklight, I have it ran perfectly. Everything's just organized. But still, just to move the cable and to take the tax out and to redesign it for wherever it is and try to hide the wires and keep it clean and non-bunched up. And
well, you probably have to just run new cables everywhere. You'd probably want to throw them all out.
Oh, yeah.
Because you'd have to recut them.
Yeah, you wouldn't even want to think about it, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a nightmare right there. It would be like spaghetti.
And over time, I seem to increasingly get more and more stuff. But right now, I've got plenty of stuff, and it's really keeping me busy. The things in my bedroom here that I use,
They're all time-saving devices in which he spends most of his time trying to save time so he can spend more time developing his time-saving devices so he can have more time.
To save the time.
Time-saving devices. Where's the problem here?
Yeah.
I don't understand.
You know, that's the truth.
You're a fruitcake.
For the most part, it's actually been me spending all my time trying to figure out what I can do with these devices.
So he can save more time.
So I can offer different services, which allow
other
to do
people.
Things.
So he can save more. They can save more time.
Yeah, I think
that's what it's all about.
But it's pretty rugged.
That's the downward spiral of the time famine society, baby.
All right. Well, to give a, we're gonna go back, and we've talked about small bits and pieces of the SCO versus the Linux open source development IBM problem. We've read a few articles. We describe what the initial problem is, and we're going to just briefly go over that again, and then we're going to give you an update on something else interesting I noticed that is being done in regards to this. Okay. Well, 2 months ago, SCO filed a lawsuit against IBM, charging the computer giant with misusing and misappropriating SCO's proprietary software, inducing, encouraging, and enabling users to misuse and misappropriate SCO's proprietary software, and incorporate and induce and encourage and enable others to incorporate, it's like reading the actual suit, SCO's proprietary software into open source software offerings. It's true that Unix owns the system. Owns the rights to Unix System 5, Caldera SCO, prior incarnation acquired from Novell in 1995, 2 years after the company had purchased them from AT&T, where Unix originated in the 1960s. And it's true that the company has to enforce those rights if it hopes to maintain a business advantage for them. It's not clear, however, that IBM has done anything SCO accuses it of. Linux is a clone of Unix. That does not mean that it uses the same source code. There's a long, clear history of business and companies reverse engineering successful products. In this case, IBM is using the work of thousands of open source programmers, of all of whom are too numerous and too poor for SCO to hit with a $1 billion lawsuit. A judge will have to examine source code and listen to arguments about what constitutes misappropriated use. If the court decides SCO is in the right, determining the appropriate penalty could take years. Kind of like Microsoft antitrust case?
Well, it's also the same thing as almost the reciprocal of what Microsoft did, is they took an open source, stole it, and then turned it into a closed source and sold it, while they took a closed source, took it, made it open source, and sold it.
Well, and now Microsoft actually... it's a statement from Microsoft. The company will license SCO's Unix patents and source code. Now Microsoft is going to be doing that. And then here's a little bit about possibly why. Some analysts said that the move, basically being the suit, was an attempt by SCO to be acquired by another company, possibly Microsoft, IBM, or another firm with a stake in the matter. I guess suing IBM wasn't enough to get them acquired.
They had to increase what their assets were to make them more valuable. So if they have a $1 billion lawsuit, on the table, then now, speculators can go, hey, they're probably going to be worth $1 billion more.
Yeah.
And so but they don't put that in the selling price, and hey, you want to acquire us, and if you buy us now, you might get this $1 billion later on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful, beautiful little business move. But now is that, you know, ethical and right? Well, we'll let history decide that one.
Yeah, it could definitely backfire. Basically, there is... I need to pull it up here. Basically, Linux Tag, they're actually taking a stance on this, and they're basically saying that they need to either have... They need to either retract their claims or disclose their proof or be fined. So now the Linux community is saying, all right, because they haven't actually showed this this code in question. They're actually saying, all right, put up or shut up. Give me the code or stop harassing us because we might fine you.
Yeah, that's called harassment.
And, you know, there may be some code out there that, who knows, you know.
But, you know, it all really does the same thing, so wouldn't it all really kind of look rather similar?
Unless a whole bunch of it looks the same. I mean, you can code things in like five different ways. It does the same thing. Sometimes more efficient. Sometimes you may use a different process of how you come about your
Yeah, but, you know, if you just kind of looked at it in bits and pieces as they kind of put the lawsuit in, is that they can go, look, these two bits of code are identical. Look, why don't you give us $1 billion for, like, five lines of code? If that was possible. Oh, yeah, baby. I'd be all over that.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you can tell by their over-exaggeration of just coming out and just spouting all this crap that there's obviously some other things behind it. And it's just some backroom old buddy stuff going on.
Yeah, it's probably really to just get themselves acquired so they don't have to work anymore. They're wanting to get out of the business realm.
Yeah, they're waiting to cash out.
They want to get into the bedroom hacking realm. That's right. That's yeah. That's where the action is.
They're going to cash out and open their own schools that teach Unix.
Hey, you know that is a possibility.
Yeah.
Who better to teach it than the ones who created it?
Yeah.
Because you rarely find that anymore.
All right. I always have trouble transitioning from one story to another because we always talk about different types of things. And moving from one story to the next can be difficult because I'm trying to think of how to transition, and it's really tough on a lot of them.
That's all right. I think we're kind of a postmodern show. I think we can kind of do a mosaic, kind of bits and pieces of, you know, little colored tiles here and there.
Definitely.
And we kind of shape the tiles into what the now show becomes as the writing's on the wall.
Yeah, we're definitely putting the information out there. I could spend, you know, I could really stretch things out, you know, each story and spend a lot of time. Sometimes we have.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of really great, these stories really illustrate, well, some of them do, on like what's really going on and kind of the perspective of where technology is moving and where the demand is. What's interesting to us? How are we recreating our world by the utilization of this great tool?
Definitely. We are definitely in the Matrix.
Darn right.
And well, we couldn't have come out at a better time. All right. Well, I had read probably 3-5 page stories about these two Russian crackers / hackers. Some of it was cracking, some of it was hacking.
But they're really just thugs.
They were thugs, but there is kind of a sympatheticness to this story. Kind of like the thug that did it only because that's the only way to survive kind of story.
Okay.
Which some of those exist, and some of those don't.
I had to live.
Well, here's the thing.
Kind of thing where they're like, you know, we're trying to put bread on the table. And so I'm going to strong arm some people.
Yeah, well, here's the thing, is that there is this group of Russian, we'll call them crackers per se, because some people might say they're not hackers, that basically called themselves, I'm trying to remember, I think they called themselves the expert, something about the expert team of security people, something like that. Basically, they had a group, these were all Russian hackers, and they would go out for the last few years. They were going out and they would crack many sites, and basically, by any means, emailing, even phone calling some of their victims, telling them about what that their systems are vulnerable, and that if they would send a set amount of dollars, that they would patch their system up and even actually watch and maintain their systems for them. Some people paid up. Some people didn't. The story went into talking about there was actually one firm in particular that they had broken into their machines and basically said we own them, and actually gave a little bit of information about the machines and credit cards and stuff like that, and asked to have them paid quite a large sum of money, a couple of tens of thousands of dollars. The guy didn't end up paying it, but what did happen is that he would string them along. He had called the FBI, the business owner, and he strung these crackers along, and even, you know, saying I don't have the money at this time. I don't think I can pay at this time. You know, I don't know if I can't pay that much money. And basically, they kept lowering their ransom, lower and lower and lower. In the meantime, they didn't do any damage to the machines. I don't know if they'd taken any information out and used it wrongfully, but it even got to a point to where these crackers would call so often, even to his home phone. The businessman's daughter would pick up the phone and say, you know, hey, it's so-and-so again, and get on the phone. They would actually, someone would talk for hours and hours, and became, I guess, friends in a way. The guy never did end up paying up, and he didn't actually hear what the FBI ended up doing with these people. Later on, there are many other instances of this, so it was a collaborative effort to basically try to get these guys. The FBI had sent issued information to the Russian government about these people and basically gotten a response. The Russian law doesn't prohibit them from breaking into other computers outside of Russia, and definitely didn't do anything about it there unless it was Russia's own computers. Some things that happened from that is from the money that they did get, supposedly that they had to pay off people from the mafia, Russian mafia, to protect them in a way, which basically means not beat them up and take all their money, but they call it protection. So from the way that the story plays out, they don't really enjoy their lifestyle, and they kept saying, look, we really want to get a real American job. We would like to come to America, and we'd like to actually get a real job doing security, what we do, and you know, get out of the situation. So at one point in time, one of their victims had actually said, okay, I have this company that would like to hire you, and they want you to come out for an interview. So they were so desperate at this point, I guess they were finally looking at building this up as being their big break, that they finally had received this, and that they finally received this opportunity, and then they went to the States. Well, the problem with that is now they could finally be arrested. They went to the States. The plane ticket was paid for the main person, which was, I think it was Vasily Gorshkov, and his friend that came along with him, they didn't pay for his ticket. But basically, he was shipped over to the United States
in a cargo crate.
They had him in for the interview, and at the interview, they asked him to show him some of his some of what he could do. So he was logging into his box back in Russia, and he was breaking into various computers and doing whatnot, yada yada, and basically flexing what he knew how to do. And then after that, after the interview was over, they left the building, and once they got a little bit down the road, and they're out of their facility that they're in, they finally arrested him. And then what the FBI did do is actually, while they're on the machine, using the machine, the FBI had logged every keystroke and everything that this person was doing. So from that point, they actually went back, used that information, logged into the Russian's computer, stole information or gathered evidence off the computer. They said it was around 2.5 gigabytes worth of data. Took all that information and actually is using that information against them in this case. And they could face up to maybe 20 years in prison and about a $700,000 fine.
So what's the moral of this story? Don't get messed up with the government.
Don't come to the United States if you're breaking into our computer so far.
Well, and don't get messed up with the Russian mafia, so you have to break and extort other people so you can protect yourself from the Russian mafia and then get hooked up, try to get a job with the people that you just ripped off. That's brilliant. Brilliant.
Well, it sounds like a desperate act. But Vasily Gorshkov, basically, since this time, he has actually issued apology letters to a lot of the companies that he had broken into, basically describing his situation as like, you know, I'm sure at first it was fun and then it became a little dangerous because people could see the type of power and access that this person had and tried to, you know, exploit him for his abilities. And then it probably became pretty unhappy and he's like, look, I went out of the situation and didn't have anywhere to go and tried to come over here. But I guess since he's been in prison, he actually has helped out people with their education as far as teaching people about math. Maybe, I don't know if they, I assume that he would help people getting their GEDs or college educations from college or just general knowledge. Sounds like a pretty smart, he sounds, by hearing the other things,
that he's trying to do the best he can with what he has.
Yeah, he did. And he actually has a wife and a child. The child is, probably like 1 year old, 1 or 2 years old. So, the government actually flew them out for the case. I don't know if they did it for some plea agreement or whatever, but he actually got to see them. So that was a good thing. That was one of the small good things out of all the bad that was going on. But
I'm done.
You're done. So that tells you right there that from just a everyday Joe standpoint, that there are people out there, and whatever the means are, you know, be it good or bad reasons, it's not like it can't be done. You know, people are doing it, and it's not talked about, and people are getting into things, and it's a big underground scene. I mean, it's big. It's very big, and they can do some powerful things, I believe, but can be some very malicious things as well.
Yeah, that's right.
And from a hacker's point of view, I guess it's just describing another hacker's life or cracker's life. He did code. He did code software. He did have people working for him that basically were a part of the group as well, that they would divvy out the money. That would code things as well. So in a way, I don't know the extent, but he is a hacker, and in other ways, he did use cracking as the ability to get into these machines. But this is another, you know, story of another hacker's life. That
I think it's the closest thing we've gotten to, I think pretty much ever, of like actually like a human interest story of like a cat up in a tree kind of feeling. Kind of thing where actually technology and life wants to evoke some kind of sympathy in the hacker world. That it's not just this pure, you know, logistical, rational realm of trying to get things done that you want done. And there's some feeling in it.
I feel that.
That's good.
All right. Now on to
goody.
Probably the most exciting part of the show for me this evening is our review of Matrix Reloaded.
Well, at least it wasn't like Metallica's Reloaded CD where they reloaded their shorts once again. This movie was absolutely spectacular.
Well, there was just to talk just outside of the movie for a moment, there was actually an interview with like Lawrence Fishburne and all the other people that were on the in the Matrix movie, the main co-stars and stars. The question was asked to him, how long do you think it will take for somebody else to do a movie as good as this movie? And he responded immediately, He said, never. And then he said, well, he backed off for a second. He said, well, let's put it this way. Either it's never going to be done, or it's going to be a really long time.
Yeah, I can so believe that. To develop a story and, like, the ideas and the visual nature of it all, the closest things that are even remotely close are, like, the new Star Wars. And that's it.
Yeah, which they're not even that good.
They are not as visually just overwhelming. I was, like, stimuli overload through 90% of the movie. It was absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, and then another thing I'll cover the outside before we start going into the movie. Another thing is that I've been noticing that critics will say that it's not as good as the first one. And my thought to that is that's a bunch of BS. And I think what they're trying to do is basically try to make themselves one up themselves over the movie by saying that, well, they're actually smarter than the movie because they see that there's a flaw in the movie, and that's why they're a better critic, because they can find that one flaw, which has got to be a bunch of crap anyways, because I've seen movies that are rated 5 stars and I go see it and it's a bunch of crap, and if they don't rate this movie 10 stars, I don't see where they're not a critic in my mind. They're just
well,
for the popularity contest of being a critic.
On this one, it was one of the more thought-provoking and thought-generating movies that I've seen in quite some time, because of the amount of levels and speculation that, you know, is invoked of what is going to happen next. You know, why was that little cue that there's something, like, one spoken word can trigger this huge realm of possibilities of what is going to happen next.
Definitely. I did notice something during the second time of viewing it that I didn't do the first. It was really hectic. I was waiting for somebody to come to that movie. I was calling on the cell phone, trying to get them to the movie, give them directions, all that stuff. It was really hectic. And I noticed it this time, and I was just even more awed about the movie. And it's actually, it's so deep that...
Well, it...
You almost turn your brain off after a certain point in time, and then you feel bad because you're like, I could go even more, you know? But I'd be here all day.
Yeah, because it brought the mindset on of, like, trying to think about how, like, our entire universe is just a single, like, atom or quark in, you know, a molecule in a completely other universe. But at the same time, it's like, they're in the Matrix, they're out of the Matrix, they're... You know, where does it end, especially in the end of where, you know, is there another Matrix? Are they still in the Matrix when they're out of the Matrix? It's just amazing.
They did a good job, even though you saw the first movie and you felt this amazement about what could be next, you know. And you didn't know there was going to be a sequel, but you just thought of all these things it could be. And even though they even gave you more information in this movie, they left you at the same point as the last movie, as thinking, holy crap, you know, where can they take this? Where can they go? And actually, to give a small hint to some people, actually, if you stay for the credits, which, man, there are a lot of people that are in that movie, that helped out in that movie, you will actually see probably about a minute and a half of the last Matrix, which is supposed to be coming out in November.
Yeah, the trailer for the third one.
But, well, I guess if you haven't seen it, we are going to get into the point of information. We'll definitely spoil the movie. So this is the end of the In and Out area. I mean, we've talked about all the stories. We're gonna end on this. We're going to talk a little bit more about this. So if you got your information, you got your take from the In and Out show this week.
You're free to tune out now.
You are free to tune out now. Play some cool music of your own. But we are now going to go into the section.
Because now it's me time, baby.
We are now going to talk about certain plot aspects of the movie. Okay. Here we go. We're in it. We're there.
All right.
All right. I'm going to let you start this off.
One of my favorite things about the whole thing is that... the counselor, was talking to Neo down in the engineering level, and he hinted at, but also illustrated, that they are in essentially this symbiotic relationship with machines, which is very similar to when they were in the Matrix, and then they need them as the machines need them, need the humans. And it illustrates that they're still, have that symbiotic relationship with the machines. That, they have some control of being able to unplug themselves, but then what are they going to do? Are they going to die without heat and food and water and all that? No, they're essentially plugged into the Matrix still. They just have a little bit more
control.
They have a choice.
And choice. This movie basically gets you to understand more about the computer world as far as the Matrix world. It's in a setting where you see a lot more about Zion. You see how the humans are living now. And like I said, you see a lot of the interaction between the programs. The special effects in this movie, like in other movies in the past, but this movie, they had to write their own code and new features just to get this stuff that you see on the screen. Now that's been done before, but some of the things that they've done for this one have been quite prolific. So they've actually advanced technology really far ahead.
What's also really neat is they did illustrate how alienated they were from their own technology, because no one cared why the lights were on and why the water was always clean.
You're talking about... Oh, okay, the humans or the...
The humans.
Okay.
Is that they, really didn't have any meaning for the machines, that they didn't create it, just like we don't, is they take it for granted.
Well, it even seems that you could apply that to the programs that are in the Matrix. A lot of them are very humanistic-like, except they're more on track, like a program would be, for what their purpose is. And
that's really all they're about, is their purpose.
Is their purpose. And it's funny because they've been there for quite some time, and you don't see them, the ones that are actually, like, holding a key position, like the, what is his name? The French guy has such a huge name.
Oh, he...
The guy that was guarding the key maker.
Well, he was an information, like, broker kind of thing.
And since he's always been around... he's still bright and full of life, and his program is still functioning like
it's supposed to. Corruption. It's the perfect fidelity of copy and transfer.
Yeah, and he will, and that's the thing you learn about the programs, is that they will continually do what they're meant to do, but they do not like being deleted.
Yeah, and that's what's really strange, is that they understand death.
Yeah.
That's what gives them this, this anthropomorphization of these program.
And it's because that they understand that they need to do something. And their whole existence has been about that. And taking away that duty will create definite problems.
Right. It's their little hell. It's their nothing, which is the lack of meaning or purpose, which is really neat, because we have the same thing. If we don't have a meaning or purpose, we have nothing. And that's... saw another movie the other night, which was... which I really enjoyed, The Harvard Man. And that's... he was a philosophy student at Harvard and was learning, was studying madness and meaning and nothing. And he essentially went on a huge LSD trip and essentially followed all the philosophers that he studied in their, delvations into madness until he finally reached nothing. And when he did reach nothing, he had a 50-50 choice of whether he might live or die to get out of that nothing. And he took it. And so these programs, and the one that essentially became Neo's nemesis, chose not to die.
Yeah, which has now created a sense of chaos within him.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, it's not really described, but his purpose is to... basically
kill.
Consume everything, and Neo is directly in his way.
Yeah. Well, and also to kill Neo, because that's his purpose, and to do whatever is necessary.
Yeah.
To do that.
Yeah.
Because that was his purpose before he was going to be.
Yeah. And now it's even more. And he, of course, he enjoys, See, it's kind of funny because it says, he says, Mr. Anderson says, or Mr. Smith, Agent Smith, Agent says in the, Mr. Anderson.
I know, it's great, great little facial and voice inflection.
Oh, yeah. The, basically, he says that, you know, Neo has taken his purpose and you know, he's very angry about that, but he's really enjoying his new talents that he's gotten. And one thing I just brain farted, I'm coming back to it, is that when he said in the beginning on the first movie, or even in this movie as well, he knows what his job is to do. Yeah. And he didn't, you could see it in the first movie and in this movie, he didn't really like his job, but he had to do it regardless because that's what he was programmed to do.
Right.
But he didn't know anything outside of what his job was, the realm.
Right.
And it seems just by giving his understanding, expressing a little bit more about what he knew he was, he's now learning what he can be and what essentially the Matrix is a part of. What's beyond just doing, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, you know, on the, that's a very low end. But what's beyond that? And he's definitely discovering that.
But yet, that's where he might actually discover, like, the human side of that is when, well, that he's actually gotten into a person in the real world, not just a Matrix person, and that he's the actual traitor inside of Zion. We'll find that out. We'll see if I'm right in the next movie.
Yeah.
And then that part of him, once it's reinfected, you know, if he goes back into the Matrix, might change the whole side of Mr. Smith and what he, you know, what his purpose will be.
Yeah, and that is something I didn't see the first time because I wasn't completely focused. But the second time, I noticed more about, well, the fact that Agent Smith was able to, you know, when they leave the Matrix and go back to Zion, he was able to transform himself into the mind of that human on the way back. But to me, that's outside of the realm of the real world, which is, we're just dropping hints here. Now we're going to get a little further. I just said that. And then we also noticed at the end of the movie that Neo had the power to do the EMP on the machines.
That's right. He was able to control the real world like he controls the Matrix. Now, whether or not that means that he's actually become
a god, in a sense, like godly powers, or...
Well, Nietzsche's Superman, where he becomes the true human creator, or... Dun-dun-dun! That the whole, like, realm between the Matrix and Zion is just another level of the Matrix.
Another control.
And then we'll find out that there's other controls and other controls. And, you know... Oh, it's a really nifty little mind screw.
And even think that it could be a control is that the thing that really tells me that it is another, that it is part of another matrix or a bigger matrix or another control, the thing that really gave me the clue was that they've done it over and over and over.
Yeah.
And he said, well, Neo says there's either two things. Either nobody knows or no one told me that this has happened 6 times or
right.
So.
That he's the 6th one.
Yeah. Well, how would nobody know? They didn't go into Zion and erase everyone's head, right? No.
No, it's because they've all been eradicated in Zion. Every time. Every time, you know, when he takes to the door, where the one takes to the door to the right, which means he takes like 17 males and 32 females.
So We're just trying to remember the details of the movie. I think it was 27 males and 16 females.
I doubt it. Oh, yeah, that could be a little bit better.
I know there's 27, like 17 or 16 or something like
that.
Yeah,
and then they go off and repopulate the Matrix and Zion.
Which now just bent my head just a little bit. I was trying to use that as a proof to say that is a Matrix. But wait, Zion could be actually a real world. And well, they just actually, do it over and over. But then that really wouldn't explain, unless we have to use some major thinking for how Agent Smith was able to transform his mind into the human's mind over in Zion.
But it also could be a genetic control, where it keeps the genetic validity of the Matrix essentially battery, the people batteries, you know, healthy, is that it becomes, they take the one, which is essentially the highestly developed one, they've, you know, and they recultivate his code, keep the control, take that, and make him the fittest one. But see, that the thing is that it's just pushing the bell curve in the direction of
perfection.
No, it's not perfection. Into the one that needs choice. Because of why Neo is the one is because he needs the choice. He becomes...
I was talking about for the Matrix to better improve its bugs.
But see, at the same time, then you yes, you get that code rewritten, but then you put back into the system as the base of the new genetic code of the genetic pool of being high as the one, and so you're pushing the genetic realm towards the way where the Matrix is going to keep having these problems.
Well, yeah,
you're going to have he didn't notice, the architect noticed that this cycle came around quicker than the one previous, and it's going to be quicker and quicker and quicker because they're pushing the bell curve of that average way over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're getting, and subsequently each time, Neo's getting smarter.
Yeah.
Or the one that is produced. Strange, though, that the one always looks the same.
Yeah, isn't it, though?
I didn't understand that. I would figure that just because I figured it would be the action-based and the thought and the choices, but not the image. I thought that was kind of interesting, though. I can't quite figure that out, why he always looks the same.
Well, then, I don't think that actually that we saw... any of the other
that
ones.
That was an assumption that maybe he looks the same.
Yeah, because I don't think we actually did see that, because then that would be really easy to pick off earlier. Now you just pick off this one phenotype. Well, that's really easy. If that only occurs one in 32 billion, well, there you go. Oh, you're done. Okay. Next, please.
Everyone with black hair and skinny pale, you're gone. this movie starts out... basically, Zion realizes that the machines are coming. Everyone's preparing for a mission to defend themselves. Also, we're waiting for the prophecy to be...
Actualized,
make it to come true, for it to continue. So they're looking to hear from the Oracle. They do get a message from the Oracle. Zion is waiting for the attack and trying to defend. And basically... Neo finds out that there's a lot more to this than needs to be than they thought before. Basically, that the Oracle was a sense of a control, which is what we've been talking about, and that control was the architect's understanding that they can understand a lot of things about humanity, but they cannot predict what your choice is going to be. They can make a best guess, but they can't quite predict what your choice is going to be. So there is a little bit of chaosism in that. And then he had mentioned that there is a, mathematically, there is going to be an odd to where somebody makes the right choices to basically understand what the Matrix is, and then therefore allowing him to gain enough knowledge for possible defeatation. Or just general ruckus. So when he meets the architect, basically the architect reveals a few little pieces that Neo didn't have in his head yet. And those pieces allowed him to realize that the Oracle was another control, and he was given two choices. One choice was to take one door, and basically the code that essentially makes up Neo in the Matrix will be reused to try to... It's basically the code for, like, the upgrade of the Matrix, which in essence, like VR just said, will continually produce faster and faster people that actually be more powerful each time, because the door for the choices is just so much smaller after the new upgrade if Neo took that one door. But if you make those new choices, you'll actually be much more powerful. And seems like this Neo is just, seems like obviously, I mean, we're watching a movie here, he's not going to die. We know that.
Oh yeah, Lee Carricker never dies.
Yeah, he's not going to die. So obviously this one has just enough, or plenty, to get the job done. But it's going to tweak a little bit later into something beyond the Architect and the Matrix. And then he was given the possibility of the other door, which there was a side bit of information going on where Trinity was in the Matrix, and she was going to get shot. He said, if you take the other door, either way, Zion's going to go. The Matrix is not going to go down. I mean, you are still here, and that's not good for us. But, you know, I guess my assumption is that they'll have some other way of dealing with it, they think. And then he's to go off and try to save Trinity. And that's his choice.
But that was what was also really neat, is that he was the only one, the only one that loved. And that's what's also really, really interesting. And that's one of the aspects of it that, you know, in good drama and theater, that it will... that's why we humans always win in all these things, is because we love and we have hope.
Yeah, that's the...
That's the moral,
that's the,
and the...
That's the feeling, yeah.
That's exactly right.
So then he actually chooses to save Trinity, and boy, I hope you people that haven't seen the movie aren't watching, listening to us now. He saves Trinity.
But of course, you know, most people are going to see this movie. And if they aren't, they live in a hole.
Yeah, that's why we did it, you know, a few weeks later after the opening, too.
Exactly.
That he actually did save Trinity. And
which was also really absolutely amazing on how that he saved her. That he actually was able to do this, you know...
representation, I believe.
Yeah, of how he... you know, like, reached in her and gave her a heart massage and pulled out the bullet. It was very godlike.
Yeah, which the way it really is happening, I think, is that it's all code. You know how they look at the screen, yeah. It's actually code. And
Neo sees it as code all the time.
Yeah, and we're looking at it as, like, imagery, but it's actually code all the time.
Which then illustrates the really neat kind of the Bhagavad Gita image of the world, is that everything's just a mere illusion, and we, you know, we actually project upon the world how, you know, like, we throw our light out to the world, and then how it comes back to us is how we understand it, is we are actually the creators of the world. And that's one of the really neat ideas of how the world of the Matrix is constructed, for me anyway. That illustrates a really ancient idea, a completely different paradigm of how to view the world.
Yeah, yeah. It definitely will make you view it. And I've consistently walked around and consistently have these ideas like I'm in the Matrix. A lot of the time.
Oh yeah.
And you know, you just it. This movie is it. It wouldn't really
take me, well, another movie that I had happen was. The one with Jim Carrey where he was, like his life was a TV show.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was my life for, like, until that movie came out, and it really ticked me off. Because I was like, I am the star of the show, and everybody is merely extras. I am the center of the universe. But, of course, I know that to be false now, thanks to my therapist. Yeah.
And Slip. And I try to leave VR in that world because he's much more interesting there.
That's right. I'm egocentric and I like it.
Then he takes the door and they actually eventually, you know, Jack's out of the Matrix and they're out of the Matrix and they're in the ship, you know, the Nebuchadnezzar. And basically all hell's broken loose. The other ship that was there basically gave... No, actually, no. I'm going too far ahead. all of a sudden the machines come in and they abandon the ship and get the heck out of Dodge and find out that, well, Neo finds out that he's able to sense these machines. And it's almost like when he, the beginning, the end of the first movie to where he knew how to get into Agent Smith. He understood that the agent was outside of what he was viewing, what he was seeing, and you know, looked at the code and basically was like hacking his code and used that to destroy him. And that's what happened, I think, when he got back to Zion. He's like, with this new knowledge, is that he understood that beyond that maybe Zion is another control as well, and now was using those senses that he never thought of applying in the real world per se. Now applies it there, and I think he understands that he's in a new you know, that those types of skills he'd use in the Matrix can be used there as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is pretty interesting.
Which is a really ancient idea of that we could actually become essentially gods in our own right of being able to, you know, to find the tricks or to blur the line of where we end and the world begins. Has been around for centuries and millennia, and it really grips the human imagination so well that it becomes almost intoxicating as part of our longing for power and control and choice, the three P's.
Definitely. So, and then he gets picked up by the only ship that was surviving in the area, because there's three ships that were sent out. Beyond Zion to actually go and meet the Oracle and help Neo and stuff like that. One of the ships was destroyed. Of course, Nebuchadnezzar was destroyed. And the last ship, I forget the name, was actually there to pick them up. They said that the only survivors were the people on the ship and Neo and the guy that Agent Smith pretty much assimilated into that went back.
Coincidence? I think not.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be a nifty plot twist, as we've already illustrated earlier, narrated earlier.
Definitely. So that's, that is, we'll probably go even more into it, but then we would get too dull. But we're going to let everyone else to do that on their own, and we'll continue to do it ourselves. But definitely a great movie. Can't wait to see the next one, and you'll be able to watch this movie for years to come. Just pop it in at any time and play it and totally
kick back, and it's like standing in facing a fan.
It's gonna be I can't even describe it. It's just gonna astound you, no matter how many times you see it or how long it's been since you've seen it.
I think next time we're gonna have to play a game and like get a little interactive with people and see how many people or how many of our listeners think that I'm actually more than one person?
Wow. How do you want to go about doing that?
I'm not sure. I think we might have to do something on the message boards or something like that you all actually get a guess, because there actually can be five of us that just go by my handle or the handle of VR that, you know, I could just be this rotating guest as well.
Yeah, but how are you going to explain the voice, though?
I think my voice changes. Well, or the voice changes from week to week rather readily.
All right. I don't know how to tackle that one. Maybe you can give us one last clue.
I don't know. We could just put something on the message board. Like, how many VRs are there?
All right. I think we'll do that.
And see how many, like, if we actually have some long-term listeners or if we just don't get a response, then, yeah, we have people download one show and then never listen to us again. Or if we actually have a fan base, that would be a very interesting question.
Well, there is a fan base, just to let you know. I watch those stats. Okay.
Oh, that's just me trying to confuse you. I download the show 50 times a day.
Oh, okay. Well, are you downloading from multiple places?
Of course.
Okay. That's the only way to do it.
Exactly. If I'm going to trick you, I'm going to trick you right.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I think that's going to wrap it up for this show. Got anything else to say, VR?
No, I'm done. I put a fork in me. I'm medium rare.
Medium rare. All right, well, that's our show, and we will see you in 2 weeks. See you then.